Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, and I thank you so much for your support. We're going to jump right into this one. We'll be looking at a very straightforward sociopath, one who kills for money and in the context of business. So this examination is about applying what we've already discussed in previous episodes about sociopaths to this case. The key to understanding sociopathy in the context of the Italian-American mafia, in which there are no women, is realizing that the absence of the woman in their evolutionary power structure means that the men, who are the redundant ones, so to speak, keep making each other redundant or dead in a never-ending pursuit to become the one, or the boss, the father, at the top of the heap. There is no procreation in a compartmentalized world of men, only a struggle to get to the top by any means necessary, so transcendence is earned in blood because it necessitates removal of another person rather than creation of one. In your family at home, a boy grows to a man and becomes the father. In the mafia, young up-and-coming members who want to be that boss find it through killing. People often hypothetically ask what the world would be like with no women. The following story is the answer. Transcendence would be delivered through murder. Okay, so it's January 10th, 1983. A New York City businessman in Brooklyn's Sheepshead Bay neighborhood arrives at work to find a maroon Cadillac parked illegally by a curb. The vehicle had been left there since the week prior, and he'd already called the police about it once. But this is New York. An abandoned car isn't exactly something that gets law enforcement jumping out of their seats to take action. There are illegally parked and abandoned cars all over the city. So the man calls back and asks again if the police will remove the car, or at least take action to learn who the owner is and have that person move it. The cops arrive at the scene and look inside the vehicle, and of course, there's nobody in it. The rear suspension on the Cadillac appears to be dipping a bit, like the trunk has something heavy in it. They push down on the suspension at the trunk area, and the reflex reacts as though their suspicion is correct. Along with the vehicle being seemingly abandoned, they believe this constitutes probable cause to search the trunk. So an officer pops the trunk and sees something very unexpected inside, a chandelier glittering in the winter sun. But then the cop notices something else, something lying underneath the chandelier, something large wrapped in a towel, and then something else, or at least another part of that object, wrapped in a leather jacket. They remove the chandelier, and beneath, they see someone's hand positioned like the person is trying to block them from seeing his face. Inside the towel is the body of a stocky man in his 40s, and there seems to be blood all over the towel and coat. Once they remove those items from the body, it's clear that this person has been dead long enough for rigor mortis to fully set in, and the freezing winter temperatures aren't doing anything to slow that process, of course. When the leather jacket comes off the man's head, it's apparent he's been shot multiple times, even in the head, including one slug behind each ear, leaving the cops to realize that the hand up at the dead man's face was the result of trying to defend himself from the shots in the only way that he could. They run the plates on the car to learn who owns it, but the police already know this notorious face. It's Roy DeMeo, a 42-year-old husband, father, and capo, or captain, for the Gambino crime family in La Cosa Nostra, who died as he lived. From this moment on, the tales about Roy's bloodlust would emerge as the stuff of legend or myth, and the sheer disregard for human life and decency would make Jeffrey Dahmer blush. Roy DeMeo wasn't just a sociopath whose violence stemmed from financial considerations and avoiding prison, as is most common in the mafia. He was a stone-cold killer, and in his crew, he kept the company of others with that same thirst for blood. The result was hundreds of murders, most of which were committed at Roy's bar, the Gemini Lounge, which was haunted by his mysterious silver-haired cousin they called Dracula. Anybody who walked in knew there was a chance they were never coming out, unless it was in pieces wrapped with garbage bags, as the DeMeo crew perfected a killing machine they referred to as the disassembly line. So let's ask ourselves, how did Roy end up in that trunk, both physically and psychologically? What led him down a road that culminated in murder? Moreover, what made him so comfortable with dismemberment that he ended up operating what essentially amounted to an actual human slaughterhouse? Let's start all the way back at the beginning, even before Roy. When the Roaring Twenties got underway and Prohibition made the sale and consumption of alcoholic beverages illegal, a young Chicago gangster named Al Capone rose to the top of the heap as a trafficker of illegal booze, a trend that swarmed the entire country and made Capone perhaps the most powerful man in the United States at the height of his power from the mid-1920s to perhaps 1931. With Capone's arrest and subsequent illness and death, along with the end of Prohibition, came a new generation of gangsters determined to strike a balance, a perfect one, between old world ideals and new world ambition. The pioneer of that movement was none other than Charles Lucky Luciano, who put forth the idea that La Cosa Nostra, which means this thing of ours, should be divided among the five crime families that would later officially come to be known as the Gambino family, Genovese family, Lucchese family, Bonanno family, and Colombo family. While the newly formed FBI was busy chasing legends like John Dillinger or Bonnie and Clyde, La Cosa Nostra proliferated within the United States. The Mafia, as part of its code, or Omerta, denied its own existence, and FBI head J. Edgar Hoover tended to do the same for much of his tenure. This allowed organized crime to infiltrate commerce like it never had before. Many immigrant neighborhoods in the first half of the 20th century in New York City were built upon local small businesses or shops, a time that long predated big box corporate stores where almost everything you need can be found in the same place. Part of the risk of running one of those shops is that the mob would come offering you protection. Basically, they were going to take a significant cut of your weekly business, and for that price, it meant you would have protection from anyone trying to interfere with your ability to make money, because it was also the mob's cash. You were wise not to refuse, as the punishment for doing so could be anything from a rock through your storefront glass to broken kneecaps to a violent death. If you got robbed or threatened, they'd take care of the people leaning on you, but you had to come up with that money every week. By the 1930s, however, with the onset of the Great Depression, a bigger business arose, much bigger, in the form of loan sharking. Loan sharking, for anyone unfamiliar, is simply offering cash loans with high weekly interest, or VIG, to people who can't go to a traditional outlet to get the money. Loan sharking is inherently violent because it's a practice that relies upon people's failure to pay, which puts them in a deeper hole and makes them more desperate, basically meaning that you could squeeze a person dry like a sponge. But loan sharking is a street crime, something for genuinely tough dudes. It wasn't for everyone. as time went on, some of the young up-and-coming gangsters started leaving that to their more thuggish counterparts and began focusing on white-collar crimes, specifically rackets. Take a guy like Tommy Lucchese. Of all businesses, he chose to dominate the garment industry, or fashion, the great majority of which was located in a small area of Manhattan at that time. He took control of the unions and jacked up his prices so that anyone looking to avoid using his workers, from the sewing machines to the trucks, would be boxed into having no choice but to acquiesce ultimately. It was still an offer they couldn't refuse, maintaining the principle of leaning on people, but perpetrated through white-collar means that only stooped to violence when necessary to overcome a roadblock that wouldn't step aside. Rackets were plentiful, from garbage to concrete, and they were huge moneymakers. Due to this, some young guys from Lucchese's era, like Big Paul Castellano, who was reclusive, quite wealthy, and liked to read the Wall Street Journal, preferred to stay off the streets and distanced from the violence. Yet when they did that, what they needed more than anything else were people on the streets who would have no problem indulging that dirty work. Castellano took over as boss of the Gambino family in the mid-1970s, and while there were many feared men within the organization, on the streets, there were two names that everybody could agree were guys who wouldn't think twice about whacking you. One was a hot-headed capo named John Gotti. The other was Roy DeMeo. Roy was one of those guys who grew up at a time when it was starting to become necessary to launder illegitimate earnings through legitimate businesses, and so it was common, even for teens coming into the life, to have a job doing something square, so to speak, while committing crimes on the side, allowing them to justify the success with anyone who inquires. So, Roy DeMeo was born in September of 1940, and by age 15, he's working at a butcher shop as a front for being a car thief after hours. He also works as a loan shark on the side, lending money to students at school. While Roy continues to work at the shop until his early 20s, in the meantime, he gets the attention of Joe Profaci, leader of the Colombo family, along with associates from both the Colombo and Lucchese families. He begins to earn a reputation as a reliable car thief, and soon enough, he comes across some associates from the Gambino family who introduce him to a guy named Nino Gaggi. Gaggi's father's cousin is Frank Scalise. It might sound funny to boast that your father's cousin is a somebody and thinks of you as close family, but that's generally how it went. Even distant relatives were held in high regard because they were blood. So Roy works in a stolen car ring for Gaggi, and by age 16 or 17, DeMeo is already meeting Frank Scalise, underboss of the family, below the boss, Albert Anastasia. For anyone not familiar, from the top down, the hierarchy used by the mafia was boss, underboss, capo, and then each capo had a crew of soldiers beneath them. So Roy is impressing everybody, even at the top, but just as suddenly, the up-and-coming Carlo Gambino takes over in the role of underboss as Frank Scalise is whacked in 1957. Of course, Gambino was behind the hit, and soon after, by the end of the year, he takes out Albert Anastasia, too. Carlo Gambino becomes the boss and appoints Paul Castellano as his underboss. Roy continues stealing cars for Nino Gaggi, and as a teen, hasn't yet committed his first murder. But as you can see, being surrounded by this constant violence, and also working at a butcher shop, is going to desensitize him in ways that most of us would find quite repulsive. Nino Gaji becomes a made guy in the aftermath of the killings, which is often referred to as getting your button or getting straightened out, which involves taking an oath at a secret ceremony, one in which you swear to be loyal to the family and to make it the number one priority in your life, above even your own family. Once you're made, there are rules about who can touch you and who can't, and you receive a level of trust and respect you might not get otherwise. Many associates don't qualify for membership, and most don't ever get made. The Gambino family, at the height of its power, supposedly had up to thousands of associates, yet only perhaps 500 members or so, making it a huge honor to get made. Obviously, Roy DeMeo wants in and is on the fast track, even as a teen. But what follows the Anastasia and Scalise hits constitutes the biggest blow to the American Mafia to that point in history. If there was a before and an after for the story of the American mob, the midpoint in which nothing was ever the same again, tipping the rise to the fall, it would be the Appalachian incident, which is often mistakenly called Appalachian or Appalachian in reference to the mountain range or region. Appalachian was a small town in upstate New York, often referred to as a hamlet, where Northeast PA mob boss Jerry the Barber Barbara kept a home. As part of celebrating a new order, with Carlo Gambino coming to power as the boss of bosses and wanting to reassure other bosses around the nation that there would be prosperity moving forward, a massive summit of mafia bosses was set to take place on November 14, 1957, only weeks after Anastasia was killed. Jerry the Barber, who had held a smaller but still significant meeting prior to that one, suggested his home might not be the best place because a local cop knew who he was and hated him. He had a couple of run-ins with this man in the past and didn't want to antagonize law enforcement any further, even if it was just one small-town cop. Yet, big shots come from all over the country, as the mafia is essentially controlled by what's known as the Commission. The Commission is comprised of the bosses of the five New York families who settle disputes in exchange for kickbacks. A boss can't be whacked unless it's approved by the Commission, which would, of course, exclude him when discussing the issue. That means all of these bosses, even from places like New Orleans and Florida, have a financial stake in the New York business and vice versa, basically making them all one big family, something the U.S. government was desperate to prove, but to that point was mostly unable. So they come to the meeting, and there are very expensive cars like Cadillacs parked all over the driveway and the lawn, many of them from out of state. Someone nearby alerts the local police, and the call, of course, goes to an officer named Croswell, who is the guy who doesn't like Jerry the Barber. Croswell shows up at the house, and upon seeing all of the out-of-state license plates and knowing that Jerry the Barber lives there, realizes he just stumbled upon proof that these organizations not only exist, but do so as part of a connected family called La Cosa Nostra. Croswell starts copying the license plate numbers, and soon enough, people inside see him doing it, but without context. Without discerning what's actually happening, everybody panics, believing the worst, and many of them take off into the woods, dressed in suits. These are some of the most powerful men in the country, but they don't want to get caught together because it validates the notion that their secret organization exists. Many of these guys were indicted for conspiracy and even went to jail, including Paul Castellano, though the charges were later dismissed because nobody actually witnessed the crime of conspiracy taking place. Running is an indication of guilt, but doesn't necessarily offer proof of guilt. And so, ultimately, they all walked. But the damage was done. Everybody knew these guys weren't gathered for a barbecue because, quite simply, they were all either easily proven to be, or reputed to be, high-ranking gangsters. The cat was out of the bag. Due to that, they closed the books, meaning no mafia associates would get made until further notice, specifically further notice from Carlo Gambino, something that reportedly lasted until late 1975 or early 1976, around the time that Gambino died. So, at age 32, in the midst of the mob wars in New York in the early 1970s, Roy DeMeo, hoping to make himself the perfect candidate for membership, begins a killing spree to show his loyalty to the family. Roy loved bladed weapons from his 7 years working in a butcher shop, but he had an even greater propensity for owning and carrying guns. For his first murder, Roy dragged X-rated film producer Paul Rothenberg into an alley and shot the man repeatedly in the head. Later, he brutalized Andre Katz by having a female informant lure him to a location on the street, where he was kidnapped from his car and taken to a closed grocery store. Inside the store, Katz was shot by DeMeo and two associates, Anthony Center and Joey Testa, before being hacked to pieces, which were distributed among multiple green garbage bags and dropped in a dumpster. Unfortunately for them, they misjudged which day the trash was collected, and so the contents of the bags, though they were discovered and ignored by one homeless man, caused enough panic by a subsequent passerby once the contents were visible that the police were called. Worse yet, the young woman used to lure the man sees the result and is horrified, as she was obviously falsely told nothing like this would happen to the man after the kidnapping. So she grows a conscience, and Roy is screwed. Luckily for DeMeo, Testa, and Center, however, the young woman who came forward was a scumbag herself, and after participating in a kidnapping with them, her credibility was shot. For that reason, everybody walked, which is a big relief, and Roy's mind is once again focused on becoming a made guy. Around that time, in 1976, again, Carlo Gambino dies, and Paul Castellano takes control as boss. Castellano is very close to Nino Gaggi, who puts in a word for DeMeo on that front. Castellano, though, is wary of making Roy a made guy because Roy has already grown a strong reputation for unnecessary violence, which is outrageously hypocritical and ironic because Castellano ordered Vito Borelli shot in the face and delivered directly to Roy DeMeo, who was waiting with a knife to dismember Borelli and ensure absolutely no possibility of an open casket, which was a common insult derived from disrespect. Apparently, Borelli cracked a joke that Paul Castellano looked like the clownish but legendary Frank Perdue of chicken fame, and word got back to the boss, who subsequently set an example by killing his ass. Castellano was often considered soft or not really a gangster, but he's known to have ordered at least 20 murders in his reign. Roy, on the other hand, thinks the killing is helping his cause to get made, and commits 3 murders in 1976, of which we can account. The first was Joseph Bracchini, a Lucchese family soldier who punched DeMeo in the face during an argument and later found himself the recipient of 5 bullets to the head in retaliation. Soon after, in June 1976, Roy and Nino Gaggi delivered vengeance against a guy named Vincent Governara, who had punched Nino in the nose years earlier, and they did so by shooting him multiple times. He dies in the hospital. A month later, after learning Nino Gaji's vacation home in Florida has been robbed, Roy asserts his loyalty once more and finds the man who tipped off the robbers, George Byram. Roy shot George in the face and stabbed him 11 times. It's not difficult to see why Nino Gaji speaks so highly of Roy to Castellano. He's a real gangster, a tough guy down in the streets. But those are the guys who worry Castellano the most because they can get out of control. So Nino, knowing Castellano speaks only one language, money, decides that he and Roy need to make a move that brings Castellano money, and the boss will finally see the light on Roy. So Nino, who does business with the Westies, who are Irish gangsters over on the west side, talks to a guy named James Coonan about the issues holding up a construction project in which both Westies leader Mickey Spillane and Gambino family boss Paul Castellano both have interests. Coonan conspires with Gaji and DeMeo, and Roy, along with another man, allegedly become the assassins when Spillane is shot dead in May 1977. Needless to say, construction begins moving again, and Paul Castellano miraculously, and finally, now that he has more money, sees the light on Roy DeMeo, approving him for membership when the boss manages to get a 10% stake in the Westies. But behind the scenes, DeMeo was allegedly involved in some things that would have not only precluded him from membership in Castellano's eyes, but also certainly have gotten him whacked as well. Yet, DeMeo was insulated. You see, Gaji was the capo of the crew that Castellano previously ran, and Paul thought highly of him, enough to trust his judgment. Yet Roy DeMeo was a different animal. Behind the scenes, he was supposedly dealing narcotics, something punishable by death for made men, and beyond that, was dealing in another big moneymaker, child porn. Gaji learned of this and told Roy he would be whacked if he continued pushing child porn, but Roy wasn't fazed. Roy kept going without fear or hesitation, which, when combined with his propensity for violence, made him a very scary man. Nino, like most, right up to the top, and including John Gotti, were afraid of Roy DeMeo because, while many of these tough guys disregarded human life, Roy was seemingly the only one of them with no regard for his own. So on this subject, it was often a matter of, if you can't beat him, join him, and Nino Gaji instead proceeded to follow into being a silent partner in the child porn ring. And of course, Roy DeMeo was also involved in prostitution rings beyond that. So, Castellano thinks Gaji, as capo, has control of DeMeo. Meanwhile, Roy DeMeo ramps up the killing in a big way. You see, Roy met a guy named Phil Grande through Nino, and Phil had a serious gambling problem, something that made him prey for Roy's loan-sharking efforts. Phil eventually got himself in deep with Roy. Too deep, and the only solution shy of taking a bullet to the head was turning over ownership of his bar. Roy accepted and proceeded to change the name of the bar to the Gemini Lounge, wherein the premises and apartment attached to the back would regularly be patrolled by the aforementioned silver-haired creepy Dracula, Roy's cousin. Joey Testa and Anthony Center went on to be known as the Gemini Twins, and because the bloodbath inside reached such notoriety, their preferred method of killing was even coined as the Gemini Method, which took place on what was called the disassembly line. A victim would be lured into the Gemini, accosted and pulled aside by one man, most often armed with a knife, who would be a distraction to allow the shooter or shooters to then approach and pump the victim's head and or body full of bullets. The head and body would then be wrapped in towels or plastic, and the bodies taken to be drained of blood, often in Dracula's shower. At that point, once it had drained and sat for a bit, the remaining blood inside the body would have congealed to the extent that dismemberment wouldn't be quite as messy. They would chop the body into pieces, place those pieces into multiple trash bags, and, since that terrible incident earlier in which they almost got caught, take the parts to the dump themselves. In June 1977, a man named Jerome Hofacker was murdered for starting a fight with Dennis Testa, a brother of Joey Testa from the Gemini Twins. The next month, DeMeo and others shot John Quinn in the back of the head and pumped three slugs into his girlfriend, Sherry Golden, after learning Quinn had testified before a grand jury. In October 1977, after a hijacking gone wrong, DeMeo murdered a man named Daniel Conti, someone he believed was going to cooperate as a witness. In November of the same year, 20-year-old John Costello was killed for the same reason. DeMeo's brother-in-law had allegedly assisted him in those two previous killings related to cooperating witnesses. So in March of the next year, 1978, when someone sets the brother-in-law up to be robbed, Roy and his crew step in. They subsequently fill Michael Mandolino full of lead, and Nino Martini suffers the same just for being present there with him. Only days later, the son of a Bonanno family capo fell victim to Roy DeMeo when Roy learned he had stolen jewelry from their crew and refused to return it. Roy showed no mercy for the son's association by way of his capo father. There was no respect that would right this wrong for Roy DeMeo. Roy was so outraged by the event that he beat and shot the man before slitting his throat from ear to ear. Roy would kill anybody, and his associates were no different by this time. In May 1978, it was learned that a Lucchese family associate had allegedly raped a young boy, and subsequently the man was lured, beaten, shot, stabbed, and sodomized with objects by Roy DeMeo and the Gemini crew, leaving him to suffer a gruesome death. Not long after that, in June 1978, DeMeo crew associate Chris Rosenberg murdered a coke dealer for trying to scam him to the tune of $10,000 at a time when 10 grand was obviously worth a whole lot more than it is now. In September 1978, a guy named Joseph Scorney was being leaned on to join Roy and Nino's car theft ring, which he refused, so Roy sent Vito Arena to bludgeon Scorney with a sledgehammer before shooting him. Arena then put the body in a barrel, filled it with concrete, and dumped it off a pier. For those of you who are fans of The Sopranos, you'd be interested to know that Vito Spadafore's storyline was inspired by Vito Arena, who was notorious for being a closeted gay gangster in a world so dominated by patriarchal, heterosexual male values that homosexuality was considered to be something punishable by death. Arena would later be convicted of that murder in 1985, and it was only after his arrest that he admitted his sexual preference to law enforcement when disclosing that he had slept with a number of men in secret. Now, here's where the practices of this crew begin to cause it to self-destruct. Part of the reason that drug dealing is forbidden by the older bosses is that it creates liability for them. If someone is selling drugs, not only are they playing with fire in terms of the potential huge criminal penalties associated with narcotics trafficking, if caught, but those people are also more likely to use. Danny Grillo, one of DeMeo's Gemini crew, gets into trouble with a drug habit, and it leads to gambling debts that he has no real chance of ever paying back. Roy realizes the same as Castellano, which is that these people are a liability, but DeMeo is going to solve the issue with murder rather than trying to enforce the rules. So, on November 14th, 1978, the crew lures one of their own, Danny Grillo, to a fate that he had dished out to others. Danny Grillo is shot and dismembered. Only weeks later, another DeMeo associate, who I had just mentioned, Chris Rosenberg, gets ripped off in a drug deal involving marijuana and proceeds to shoot the other man before stuffing him in the trunk of a car and lighting it on fire. In February 1979, Roy DeMeo kills a cocaine dealer named Peter Waring, someone he suspects is an informant. His arrival at the Gemini Lounge ends in a familiar way as he suffers a shooting, stabbing, and dismemberment. After murdering a supposed rapist named Scott Cafaro on a contract allegedly paid for by the victim's family that same month, Roy DeMeo and Chris Rosenberg shoot and stab a pornographer to settle a dispute. Only weeks later, Rosenberg is involved in a huge cocaine deal involving 12 kilos that goes terribly wrong because he tries to rip off the other party. He was shot in the head and arm, but survived the incident. Rosenberg must have been a very good shot because he managed to kill both Charles Padnick and William Serrano that day, along with two other men believed to be Cuban whose names weren't disclosed. So obviously, this crew is completely out of control at this point, and we can see how drugs and violence, along with the associated paranoia, play a crucial role in that downfall. But it gets worse. A lot worse. Jamie Padnick, the son of one of the victims in that previous incident I just mentioned, Charles Padnick, comes to New York asking questions about his father's disappearance. This turns into a case of play stupid games, win stupid prizes, as Jamie learns firsthand exactly what happened to his dad by getting shot and dismembered by Roy and company at the Gemini. Now, due to this failed drug deal and the subsequent massacre, along with one of the victim's sons coming around asking questions, Roy gets seriously paranoid about retribution, especially considering that there were Cubans involved that he believes might come asking questions with perhaps a little more force than one man's inquisitive son because they're associated with a cartel. Plus, heat from law enforcement is gaining traction, as are the rumors about him. The paranoia crescendos a month later, in April 1979, when Roy goes off the fucking deep end. Roy comes home one day to see a young man sitting in a car outside his home, someone he believes looks suspicious, and specifically because the guy appears Cuban to him. Roy is obviously offended to the greatest extent because the danger is apparently at his home, and it was there before he arrived, meaning his family could be the target. The young guy appears to be going through some papers in the car, so Roy slips inside the house and asks his wife if she had seen the man. His wife tells him that the young man came to the door trying to sell her a vacuum, which enrages Roy because he's convinced this guy is a Cuban assassin. So Roy gets a gun, goes out front, and yells at the young man. The kid sees the angry man with the gun and floors it out of there. Roy gets in his car and gives chase for 7 miles, all the while trying to line up a shot on the vehicle. He's finally able to corner the other vehicle by getting it to crash, and he shoots the 18-year-old man inside to death before fleeing. In fact, he shoots him 7 times. Law enforcement arrives to find the body of Dominic Ragucci, who was a college student selling vacuum cleaners door-to-door to pay for tuition. Roy was so far gone by this point that it was only weeks before he tried to rectify that situation by killing his own crew member once again, this time in the form of Chris Rosenberg, who was responsible for ripping off the Cubans in the first place. Roy had hesitated in taking out Chris, even when he was told to do it, because Chris was sort of a son to Roy. Chris came from a Jewish family and essentially wanted to get away from that heritage or almost forget it, you know, being essentially adopted into this Italian family. And Roy kind of became that father to him as the older man. So his feelings led him to hesitate, and his hesitation led to the paranoia, which pushed him over the edge. At this time, however, the only thing keeping Roy from coming apart at the seams and getting whacked himself is the insulation provided by Nino Gaggi being the capo of this Gambino crew. He was very close to Castellano, like I said, and so Castellano considered him worthy of keeping DeMeo on a short leash. But that changed. In fall 1979, a Gambino capo named James Eppolito went to boss Paul Castellano and stated that he knew Nino Gaggi and Roy DeMeo were dealing drugs and could prove it because they ripped off his son for $7,000. Castellano's instincts told him they were right and that he should take action against Gaggi and DeMeo, but his allegiance to Gaggi caused him to secretly go the other way and give Gaggi and DeMeo a green light to whack Eppolito and his son. On October 1st, 1979, father and son were shot in the back of the head in a car parked in Coney Island. And it's here that Castellano's choice would come back to haunt him. Gaggi and DeMeo walked away from the scene of that crime, but intentionally went in different directions afterward. Unfortunately for Nino, he went in the direction where he ended up coming across the cops, and he was arrested. With Gaggi in prison, Roy DeMeo was named acting capo of that Gambino crew. By this time, however, his stolen car ring was becoming a liability, and the competition was forcing him to resort to violence to maintain his position. Only weeks after the Eppolito incident, when he should have been lying low, Roy murders two men associated with a competitor, and with the suggestion that they were likely informants cooperating with the police. And that begins a pattern. In March 1980, DeMeo stabbed and decapitated Joseph Coppolino after the man allegedly served as an informant for police on a huge shipment of marijuana that ended up being seized. In May of that year, 21-year-old Patrick Penny, who was warned by Roy DeMeo not to testify against Nino Gaggi at trial, was shot 9 times in the head. The point was made. By September 1980, Paul Castellano ordered Roy DeMeo to murder his son-in-law, Frank Amato, after learning Amato raised his hands to Castellano's pregnant daughter. In April 1981, the Gemini twins shot James Bennett, who was suspected of being a cooperating witness against their crew. In December 1981, Roy murdered and dismembered Joseph Viciano in an 11th floor office in Times Square, at which point the man's son Paul and brother Al made the mistake of going to look for him. DeMeo suggested he could assist and proceeded to lure them to the Gemini, where they also met a horrible fate. Next, DeMeo murdered John and Anthony Romano, who were suspected of setting up one of his associates to be robbed years earlier. In October 1982, only a few months before Roy's death, he murdered another Gambino family associate who had sent word up the ladder that he was dealing drugs. The big problem with these accusations about drugs is that the RICO statutes that allow leaders of organized crime to be held responsible for crimes committed by others under their control came into play in a big way as the 1980s rolled around. RICO was written back in 1970, but it wasn't until the proliferation of listening devices, such as bugs and wires, that caught the bosses giving the orders that these things became a huge concern. If Roy was dealing drugs and committing a lot of related murders, the heat from the FBI that comes down on the boss is going to get too hot to handle. Because, quite simply, if Roy is dealing drugs under RICO, then that activity makes the boss a drug dealer as well. And if the money from those drugs can't be accounted for in full without disclosing it as drug money, then kickbacks up the ladder to the boss actually become dangerous, meaning that guys withhold the profit from the boss, but still make him assume the risk, playing him for a fool. By the early 1980s, the feds had not only bugged Castellano's house by interfering with his cable TV and forcing him to call for repairs, leading to an agent coming out to install a listening device, but Castellano's own underboss, Tommy Bellotti, actually held the flashlight while the work was done. He had no clue it was FBI, but both he and Paul Castellano would soon find out the hard way that it was. In that light, it was pertinent that a guy like Roy DeMeo disappears for good. The heat coming from his stolen car ring made it a done deal. Nobody actually knows what happened other than those involved, but it's believed that Roy was called to a meeting with Nino Gaggi and the Gemini twins, at which point they gunned him down while he was taking off his coat. Roy knew it was coming, maybe not in that moment or on that day, but he had expressed, even to his 17-year-old son Al, that the end was near. Guys like Roy didn't run from these things. They faced it down. Castellano's instincts were correct, but he was too late. He had originally offered the contract on Roy's head to John Gotti, but Gotti was afraid of retribution from the DeMeo crew, as they had reportedly been involved with hundreds of murders over the last 10 years, so he turned it down. They were extremely violent. Castellano then allegedly went to Gaggi with the request, and as close as Roy ever got to Gaggi, Nino's allegiance was still to his old friend, the boss. While Castellano's instincts, again, were great in regard to the drug dealing, it was actually still his downfall. In the same way he got caught on audio surveillance, so did a lot of other people, including John Gotti. And one of the things Gotti got caught discussing on an FBI wiretap around that time was dealing narcotics. There was nowhere to hide from the truth, but Gotti had time on his side in the sense that Castellano had not yet heard those tapes. Knowing he would be whacked if Castellano did hear them, Gotti precluded that action by engineering an audacious hit on Paul Castellano outside Spark's Steakhouse in Manhattan in mid-December 1985, making himself the boss in the aftermath. But legal troubles would plague Gotti, and by 1992, he was behind bars for murdering Castellano, among other things, after underboss Salvatore the Bull Gravano flipped and became the highest-ranking turncoat the mafia had ever seen. It was the era of the rat, the end of Omerta, and it was all precipitated by enforcing RICO in the families. Castellano, along with the other bosses, was also caught on FBI surveillance gathering to meet at a single location, verifying the existence of the commission. On April 17, 1988, Anthony Nino Gaggi was confined to a cell and awaiting a second trial stemming from earlier charges. He began to suffer a heart attack and complained to the guard on duty of chest pains, but the guard failed to take action, and he died. Gaji's wife sued the prison system and won with supporting testimony by other inmates. And finally, on June 10th, 2002, John Gotti died from throat cancer in prison. So, at the culmination of this violence, I think back to Roy's early days and the stories about who he was as a kid. Supposedly he got picked on as a small child and was traumatized by his brother being killed in combat when he was young. Roy's first legitimate job, so to speak, was working at a grocery store, and what everybody noticed about him, in contrast to the other kids, is that he worked much harder. Yet, you have to understand why he was motivated to do that. Roy, who had been picked on, and perhaps even abused, understood that if he worked harder than the other kids, they would have less money than him and would thereby look to him for loans. So he started loaning that extra pay to kids he already knew didn't have the capacity to pay it back on the terms agreed upon, so that when they failed, he would have license to continue kicking the shit out of them, which he did. It's not who he became. It's who he always was. Roy's purpose in life was to hurt people while making sure he gained from it and never lost, which is a sociopath's dream. For all intents and purposes, however, the glory days of the American Mafia were over. As I discussed at the start of the episode, Roy prevented his daughters from learning about his job, and they went on to be successful, even one of them attending an Ivy League school. But his son was a different story. According to Roy's son Al DiMeo, Roy once gave him $5,000 cash and a .22 pistol as Christmas gifts, telling the kid, quote-unquote, twice in the head and make sure he's dead, when he was only 6 years old. Six. His dad also taught him how to hotwire cars, and because he wouldn't draw suspicion from cops as a boy, Roy would often have Al transporting guns into mafia hangouts under his shirt or other clothing. Roy also believed Al needed to be a bodyguard for his sisters at school and began sending the 13-year-old there every day armed with a .25 caliber pistol to accommodate. Let me put this into context for you. In today's terms, that $5,000 cash that was given to a six-year-old would be worth more than $36,000. They lived in an upscale home in Bar Harbor on Long Island, escaping the crowded neighborhoods of Brooklyn. And Roy was so infamous that tourists would regularly drive by his home just to get a glimpse. Roy was powerful, respected, and most of all, feared by everyone. By the end, however, when his son was 17, he was trying to pull the boy into a scheme to shoot him in the side so he could fake his own death and disappear to avoid his inevitable murder. He believed getting shot would produce enough blood and gore for detectives to believe he had been whacked and dumped somewhere. When it was apparent that he wasn't really going to run, because he'd always been someone to face the storm head on, he sat down his son Al and said something that I think gives us as much insight into who Roy DiMeo was that we'll ever need. It was the day of his disappearance, and before Roy drove away from his home in that maroon Cadillac for the final time, even pretending for his wife that he was going to be able to return with that chandelier fixed, he called Al into his study and revealed to his son that he was going to be killed. He gave instructions for what should transpire in the aftermath. Quote, "Put me in a garbage bag and throw me away, and then pretend it never happened. End quote. Just like that, he was gone forever. And now we see the way Roy left his victims was actually a manifestation of how he saw himself. And with that knowledge, we understand that the life he lived was the only way he knew how to admit it. And though we're very different, it resonates with us because, in one way or another, we all live that life, believing we're running towards something when it's really over our shoulder and chasing us into the light.